You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, November 11th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor of Political Science at Notre Dame, Benjamin Radcliffe. On his new book, The Political Economy of Human Happiness, How Voters' Choices Determine Quality of Life. Libertarians, prepare your heads for the imminent explosion that may take place. Also on the program today, a deal with Iran moves one step closer despite the French and the Saudis having some issues, not to mention John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Benjamin Netanyahu and Chuck Schumer, maybe. Also on the program today, the Benghazi fallout from Benghazi. I don't know if I have the energy to talk about it any more than that, but... Lindsey Graham still holding on white-knuckled to Benghazi as a way to fend off a right-wing challenge in his upcoming election. Fukushima TEPCO has put off their plan temporarily to remove nuclear spent fuel rods. And in Virginia, that attorney general race is separated by literally half dozen ballots. Republicans have changed the rules about counting provisional ballots after the election. Talking out of 2.2 million votes. And we will get to just a horrible, horrible natural disaster in the Philippines. Although, I don't even know if it's fair to call these natural per se anymore. But before we do, just a reminder, today is November 11th. We have four more days, is that right? To vote in podcastawards.com. Folks, you can vote every day for the next 4 days. You go to podcastawards.com. Vote for us for People's Choice and Best News in Politics. You got to put your email in, and then you've got to check your email and your spam filter just to make sure that you confirm that you're a real person. I keep harping on it, but it's very important to us, and it costs you nothing but a couple of moments out of your day, and it makes a big difference. Because then I'm going to have to rewrite the opening of this show if we don't win the award. I'm not going to harp about 2012, although maybe I will. So please head over there now. Just a devastating storm that hit the Philippines over the weekend. Could be up to or more 10,000 people killed. The country is just so devastated now that there's just no way of knowing. It could have displaced somewhere around 600,000 people. The city of Tacloban, city of over 200,000, just completely obliterated. The typhoon, or they're calling it a super typhoon, Haiyan. It's It's estimated to have destroyed 70 to 80% of the structures in its path as it tore into the coastal provinces of Leyte and Samar. With winds 195 miles an hour, gusts up to 235 miles an hour. There's just really no way of knowing. I mean, the death toll could go well past 10,000 at this point. Baco, a city of 35,000, 80% underwater. 9.5 million affected. I guess that's a technical term, across nine regions. This is according to the UN. It's just enormous devastation. And, you know, of course this is a natural disaster, but we're going to see more and more of these extreme weather events as the nature of our climate changes. Just the reports are just brutal. So as the week goes on, we will talk about relief efforts and where you can donate. I don't even think they're at that point now in terms of being able to even come close to beginning the recovery process. Just a horrible tragedy. And like I say, folks, we're entering into an era where this is going to be the new normal. And if we're not there already, I mean, we're seeing one of these every couple of years at this point. So, but we're going to take a break now and talk more of, I guess, what we do in non-crisis times with Benjamin Radcliffe and his book, The Political Economy of Human Happiness, How Voters' Choices Determine Quality of Life. That's right, folks. Seems as if there is extensive data saying that the nanny state is also the happy state. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at Notre Dame University, Benjamin Radcliffe. He is the author of the new book, The Political Economy of Human Happiness, How Voters' Choices Determine Quality of Life. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start in. And we'll take this into the sort of the less sort of data driven and empirical in a moment. But I want to start out. What was the basis in which you decided to undertake this study?
Well, to be perfectly honest, it was a personal, professional, and I suppose ideological kind of desire to get away from doing the kind of drab, ordinary research that I was trained to do in graduate school, and that which dominates ordinary academic political science. You know, studying voting behavior and interest groups and things like that, which are all important and which I've done work on in the past. But I thought one of the advantages of finally being a full professor and having tenure and so on would be to do something a little more daring and risky and a little more in tune with the actual needs of the world. So I thought that the basic question of, you know, what is it that makes people actually enjoy being alive was a more important question than how many dimensions there are to party identification.
And so when you and I agree, and what constitutes, I mean, as you start to go out and look for what makes people happy to be alive, I mean, what is, how do you define that sense of happiness? Because in many respects, I think your work here, this will be, I think, clear to people as we go on, your work here, you know, it answers one of the central questions of about why we organize in societies. Although it also still leaves one sort of question that transcends it, and that is, on some level, like, what is happiness? So how did you go about choosing or determining what constitutes happiness?
Well, I mean, a good question. Obviously, happiness is a complicated issue. It's one that people have been talking about for as long as there have been people. But from a social science point of view, it's actually an easy question. The way we like to refer to what we're studying is subjective well-being, using happiness as a more colloquial term. And then all we're getting at is that idea that I mentioned a moment before is we define happiness as the extent to which people find their lives to be to be satisfying. That is, you know, we're not trying to get inside people's heads to try to figure out what they mean by happiness. That's why it's subjective. What's happy to one person may be not what's happy to another person. And rather than most of the philosophical debate about happiness is on, you know, what is it or what it should be. From a social science point of view, we're only interested in whether people think they're happy or not, right? We're not interested in whether they're deluded into being happy. If they think they're happy, then they are happy. So it simply becomes a question of finding the right kind of instrument, which in order to study large numbers of people means using survey data, of finding the right kind of question to get at what we're actually interested in, which is, again, you know, people's underlying, deeply held, sort of enduring sense of the extent to which they find life to be a positive experience. You know, it changes according to life events, but it's not a passing mood, you know, whether you're going around with a smile on your face today or not. It's your underlying sense of do you find your life to be a good life. So the trick then is just to find the right kind of survey questions that seem to get at what we're really want people to tell us. And then, you know, there's a whole little cottage industry of people who study survey questions, and they look for them having certain structural features which imply that they're good questions. So we can talk about some of that if you want. But the short version is that the typical question that we use as a measure of happiness is a question which asks people something like, taking all things together, how would you evaluate the quality of your life today? Or the real wording usually uses a phrase like, how satisfied are you with your life? Which I think sort of gets at the underlying idea. Are people satisfied with their life?
And so when you ask that question, where give us the, and there's basically three aspects of this apparently that you have found that promote more or the most rewarding lives in terms of, I guess, society, the way the society is structured. And tell us about what societies do we find that people feel they have the most rewarding lives?
The country that everyone lately has been holding up as the exemplar, the one that seems to come out in all the different surveys, no matter what kind of question you ask, what survey team is doing it, and so on, is Denmark, with the other Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands sort of in that top cluster of the happiest people. And then the sort of continental Europeans, roughly speaking, somewhere in the middle, the Americans, and then you get sort of a scattering then of the rest of the world after that.
And so
again, Denmark is the exemplar that everyone looks to.
And so what is it about those countries? I mean, your research finds that there's basically, like I said, three different aspects to it. Outline for us what those three aspects these countries all share.
Well, I mean, the three dimensions that I focused on is the size of the welfare state, or the size of government in general. That is all the services and protections that the government provides, the social safety net being the most obvious example. The second is the strength of the labor movement, the percentage of workers who are organized into unions. And the third are sort of similar to the first, are labor market protections. That is, how easy or difficult is it to fire people? Do they require severance packages? Do they have some kind of essentially a collective bargaining type agreement that prohibits them from being arbitrarily dismissed? Do they have a large number of vacation days? A lot of Europeans have 28 days of paid vacation. Do they have sick days and so on, which, you know, a lot of Americans don't? Those are the sorts of the three areas: the welfare state, labor organization, and labor market regulations.
Let's talk about the welfare state. I mean, what is it about the size? Do you break down as to what the aspects of the welfare state? I mean, you can look at it as what percentage of GDP of a country's GDP is spent by the government on programs that essentially give back to the people. Is that accurate? I mean, that's
one of the main measures. Spending is one of the main measures. So you look at different. You can look at either the percentage of GDP that, as you put it, goes back to the population. You can also look at just the overall amount of government spending as the size of the economy, which sort of is a cruder measure, but which gets at, again, how much government does. But the better measures are more specific ones, which look at direct aspects of the welfare state. So one of them, for instance, produced by the OECD, which they label the social wage, is a way of looking at the generosity and the extent of unemployment benefits. So they'll compute, for instance, for the typical family of four with one wage earner, they'll get back 75% of their wages for a maximum of a year, say. That kind of way of looking at the precise amount of income replacement that people would receive, and taking into account the percentage of people who would qualify and so on. So you try to get past some of the crudeness of spending and look at a bunch of different particular measures of what you might call social rights. That is, the extent to which people are guaranteed these kinds of things, in the same way, say, that Americans are guaranteed Social Security and Medicare.
And so, the second aspect being the sort of the strength of unions. I mean, how does this translate to, in other words, are there different responses? Is there a level of self-consciousness as to people are particularly happy about governments doing X, and they're particularly happy or unhappy about the existence of unions? I mean, how does that break down in your research, or is it simply, in other words, is there a bright line of causation here?
Well, I haven't looked at it in quite those terms. The way I tend to think of it is that people benefit from labor unions in two respects. One is at the individual level, that is, they or a member of their family belong to a union or are covered by a union collective bargaining agreement, and that provides them with a power resource against potentially arbitrary employers. Right, it provides them with a whole series of protections against arbitrary dismissal, but also grievance procedures in the workplace, and generally, it sort of alters the relationship between workers and employers and makes it less of a one is a subordinate to the other. It creates an independent source of power as a counterbalance to the employer, which works to the advantage of workers and to their families. More importantly, perhaps the secondary aspect of the overall strength of the union movement, not not whether you belong to a union or a member of your family, but the overall percentage of people who do, you know, that creates a political power resource, a resource that's generally used on behalf of the kinds of public policies that tend to benefit everyone, and that those policies, you know, make the world a better place. So, you know, there's an old bumper sticker that says, the labor movement, colon, the people who brought you the weekend. That's only a slight exaggeration, if any. So the idea of the power of the of unions across countries is manifest in their footprint on public policy. And in most of these countries, including the United States, it's been labor unions that have fought for and provided a lot of political clout for, you know, all the programs that essentially help foster and create the middle class, like, again, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, student aid, all the kind of stuff we take for granted, the 40-hour work week, the minimum wage. All this kind of stuff comes about in large part, due to the power of unions. So where unions are more powerful, you get these changes in public policy that are more consonant with the interests of ordinary people.
And then another mechanism in which, at the very least, workers are protected, but it's also true for consumers, is the state's efforts on basically in regulating labor regulations and consumer protections.
Right, exactly. Of course, yeah. I mean, I focus less in my book explicitly on empirically on consumer protection, but theoretically that argument is definitely there, that unions provide that same kind of political pressure on, you know, financial regulations, like after the Great Recession, but just the whole general panoply of consumer protections that we take for granted. Even things like the EPA exist in part because of labor unions.
And so, to the extent that these conditions are created that makes everyone happy, do you see this cut? The happiness, I imagine the happiness writ large, it cuts across ideological spectrums, it cuts across age spectrums. Is there an awareness of these factors? In other words, are there other factors that make people happy, I guess, in these countries? To what extent do these people attribute their happiness to those areas of life, I guess, that have been affected by these government policies?
I can't really speak to that. I haven't studied the attribution question, which I think is an important one. You know, my instinct is that in Western Europe, at least, people are aware of all the things that the government does for them. You get some of the classic examples. I think in Germany, every time a couple has a child, they receive, regardless of their income or social class, they receive something called a baby basket from the government, which is just in the same way that in a lot of European countries, people receive family allowances. That is, you get a check from the government, regardless of your income, for every child that you have, as a way of society expressing its interest in maintaining the health and welfare of its children. And so when you see those kind of benefits that occur to you in a obvious kind of way, and when they're politicized, so that you they're not just taken for granted the way they are in the United States, as if Medicare just came out of the sky, I think people make that sense of attribution and realize that the government and the labor unions that are protecting them, are making a difference. But I don't literally have data to speak to that.
You know, it's fascinating because you talk about, like, these baby baskets, which are just I almost cried when you just said that. I had a kid 7 months ago. I would love a baby basket. But it just, you know, today I was reading Greg Mankiw had and this is not directly related to your research, but Greg Mankiw, I guess he was a former Bush economist and a McCain advisor, I believe, and I don't know, he was predicting in 2007 the stock market would go to 36,000, if I remember correctly, but he was writing about the community rating aspect of the Affordable Care Act, essentially, which means that many people enter into the risk pool and you'll be paying for things that you wouldn't necessarily pay for, like maternity care. And and this quote really stuck out at me, and it speaks to what you're talking about. But he says, having children is more of a choice than a random act of nature. People who drive a new Porsche pay more for car insurance than those who drive an old Chevy. We consider that fair because which car you drive is a choice. Why isn't having children viewed in the same way? Which brings about sort of the argument that people are being discriminated against in their health insurance under the Affordable Care Act because they're being forced to pay for things like people who have children.
Right.
Whereas, you know, obviously, if I'm in Germany and I don't have kids, I'm being forced to subsidize someone else's baby basket. Yet in
right.
Germany,
well, that we pay for other people's kids to go to school, right? I mean, it's we pay for police protections we don't need. We pay for a lot of stuff that we as individuals don't see an immediate return on, but we do so because it's not only fair, but it's in the best interest of society in the long run.
And the point is that I guess is that at the what is in the best interest of society in the long run ends up bringing us happiness as individuals. In the real time, now.
I'm sorry, I lost you there.
The idea that you know what benefits society in the long term makes us happier now.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. Ask me the question.
Well, the idea being that what makes society better in the long run is, according to your research, anyways, at least correlates with what makes us happier now.
Oh yes, of course. Right. Exactly. The things that we do right now, we don't have to think of them as an investment. You know, the government spending, the creating labor unions, these things don't have immediate costs which we then collect later as in an insurance policy. We're getting back a direct benefit right now from making these kinds of investments in ourselves and in our neighbors.
So, I mean, as a political scientist, when you look at an era when we are, you know, even with a Democratic president talking about cutting, you know, we are still in many respects living in an era of austerity in this country. I mean, how do you reconcile this? I mean, how is it that we are the wealthiest nation in the world, but not necessarily the happiest?
Well, I mean, I think you know the answer to that last question. It's because we haven't made those same kinds of investments in ourselves and in our economy that countries like Denmark have. They've chosen a different you know political economy model in which they pay higher taxes and get higher benefits. One of the things I show in the book actually is that higher taxes, a higher tax burden is associated, other things being equal, with happier people. Not because people want to pay taxes, of course, but because taxes are the engine that provide everything back that we get. So, you know, I think the debate about lowering taxes and cutting benefits and so on from the point of view of my research is, you know, is ridiculous. Those are exactly the things that will make the world a less better place rather than a better one. That austerity is is foolish.
But I mean, you know, on its face, I mean, it seems obvious to us as we discuss it that it's foolish. But I mean, how do we get ourselves in this situation? In other words, you know, the subtitle of your book is "How Voters' Choices Determine Quality of Life." How conscious are those choices that are being made? I mean, relative to those countries that whose choices have brought about a greater degree of happiness versus ours.
Well, I mean, I think the only answer has to be a failure of elites in the Democratic Party and in the progressive movement to make these kinds of arguments, to even be debating austerity or the deficit as the biggest issue facing the country in the times in which we're living is you know a poor political choice. That our side has bought into the arguments of the right that the deficit is the biggest issue facing the country, and that by definition and Bill Clinton's famous phrase that the big government is, you know, that era is over, that big government is a bad idea. I think for all his many commendable things that he's done as president and his, I think, genuinely good instincts, that the line that Obama has bought into as well, which is that somehow or other we have to try to, whenever possible, cut taxes and shrink government. And, you know, there's obviously a case to be made for not having a government that, that isn't doing things and that, and so on. But just abstractly, at least according to my research, you're going to live in a better world where everyone is better off, to the extent which government tries to intervene in the market to produce better outcomes. I mean, the basic problem is that the capitalist economy is in many ways a great and wonderful thing. It's one of, in the book I say it's one of humanity's greatest achievements, but it has all these negative aspects to it that, you know, it doesn't care about fairness, it doesn't care about people. Government as an agent of citizens can care about people, but we have to understand that voters, you know, can only be expected to have a limited amount of sophistication. That's what political leadership is for. The Democratic Party needs to be making arguments for big government rather than apologizing for it.
Now, I can tell you that in all likelihood, after this interview, I'm going to get calls from libertarians in particular who will tell me that you're not accounting for liberty and freedom, and I'm not sure I know what that's going to mean per se in that instance, but that is sort of almost the question that transcends the question about whether or not a nanny state makes you happier in some respects. What's your response to that, to the idea that do you understand that?
Yeah, you know, I know where you're going with this. I think it's a great question. Let me say two things. I think there is an intellectually coherent and even in some respects morally compelling argument that the right makes about one of the advantages of a market society is that it promotes liberty in the sense that from their point of view, in some abstract way, if you get government and unions out of the equation, what you have is a bunch of free individuals facing each other in a free market, making free decisions about what's best for them. And that has a certain appeal to it. I mean, that does embody liberty. I think what is wrong with that argument is that it fails to consider the fact that, unlike in a voting booth where everyone is equal, everyone isn't equal in the market. So, you know, we're all at liberty to make vast amounts of money trading stocks, but we have to have, you know, a vast amount of money to do that. So, you know, I think that there is a core of something to be said for the libertarian argument, but I would spin it the other way around. And I always argue that the welfare state, I know Americans hate that phrase, but the nanny state, the social safety net, whatever we want to call it, that it promotes liberty, it promotes freedom, the sense that you're in control of your own life. And in this sense, that what is it that unemployment insurance or disability insurance or Social Security or Medicare, what is it these things do? I mean, essentially, they provide us with security. They provide us with a little bit of security so that we know that if we have to make hard choices, do we want to quit our job and go back to school? Do we want to quit our job to care for an ill family member? You know, can we, or if we just can't find a job, right? Are we facing destitution or homelessness or not being able to take care of our children if we can't find a job in a market where there's 8% unemployment or 7% unemployment? So the welfare state then, you know, instead of somehow enslaving people, I think frees people, right? It makes them less dependent on the market. It makes them less necessary to behave as a commodity, as someone who just sells their ability to do work. And if you can't succeed in doing that, you know, you face impoverishment and financial ruin and so on. So that, you know, that the metaphor I always like to use is that the welfare state is like a tiny little trust fund that people have, and it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think that having a trust fund empowers you, that it gives you more control over your life, right? And rather than taking it away somehow, of somehow enslaving you, it's a resource that's there to help you when you need it. And in that sense, then, the welfare state provides people with that control over their lives that comes from having that little bit of independence, just a little bit, from the necessity of you know, being at the mercy of the market.
When people break down what they're talking about in terms of happiness in your studies, or in the studies that you've looked at, are there specific qualities that are associated with happiness? Because you say security. I mean, this is an argument that I make too, is that, you know, if you're trapped in your job because it's the only way you can get health care, your right. freedom theoretically is curtailed. I mean, you know, I'm curious as to those who express more happiness, what they constitute as the most important qualities that lead to their happiness.
Again, that's something I can't really speak to. It's a sort of attribution stuff of how people, you know, account for their own happiness or lack of it is, you know, it's just not something I feel qualified to speak about.
Right. Okay. I mean, because you mentioned, like, you know, the idea of security, and I mean, ultimately, you know, I guess it's sort of freedom from what ends up being the sort of, I guess, the question that is where these political ideologies are at loggerheads, right? I mean, it's one is from the tyranny of government, and then the other is from the tyranny of the market, I guess.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the both can be tyrannical. There's no question about it. But if you have a democratic government, however flawed, if you have an accountable government, at least it's accountable. Right? The market is accountable to no one, which to conservatives is one of its great advantages. Right? Von Hayek talks about Margaret Thatcher would talk about the spontaneous order created by the market, in which human interventions, attempts to make the world a better place, taxes, government programs, all of that stuff just sort of vanishes from view. You know, I prefer a world in which ultimately, and I think this is the real, when push comes to shove, this is the issue at stake, is do we want to live in a world in which the only source of power is the power that we find in the market, which means wealth, or do we want to have the ultimate source of power in society reside in the democratic process, in the electoral process, and where at least nominally, in some minimal way, everyone's vote counts the same?
Well, it's fascinating stuff, and I appreciate your coming on to talk about it. Professor Benjamin Radcliffe from Notre Dame. The book is The Political Economy of Human Happiness, How Voters' Choices Determine Quality of Life. I appreciate you coming on to talk about it.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful for being on.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half in a moment, in which I will get to that FDA story about trans fats. Apparently, we do have Bloomberg to thank for something. And I may get to the Benghazi stuff if I can bring myself to talk about it. And interesting piece by the Wall Street Journal on a trade deal that is being negotiated parallel to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but has the same issues. And of course, from the Wall Street Journal's perspective, they see nothing wrong with this that I find somewhat problematic. And from last week, new FOIA request shows that the FBI monitored antiwar.com for fear that they were out to get the FBI. But it was all just a mistake. All that and more on the better half of the program. Folks, you can support this program in a number of ways. One, you can go to podcastawards.com, vote for us for best political news show and People's Choice. Put your email down. They'll send you an email to confirm that you're a real person. We need your votes. You can vote every day for the next 4 days. Or you can spend 35 cents a day and make sure that we're able to continue to bring you 40 minutes of great programming every day, and then get a bonus of another 50 minutes of program in the much funner filled half. Today,
Benghazi, we could be going somewhere.
Yeah, Benghazi could be super fun. I don't know.
I was just reflecting on that was bringing me back to my days in college, like that total, that real seriousness about, well, I can make a claim here. I can't necessarily make a claim there that the professor was doing. And I was just contrasting it with like all of the Benghazi people. It's like, I could definitely make a claim about something. I have absolutely
no idea.
I'll make something up in my head.
We'll do an entire TV show and put out a book about it. Are you kidding? We'll also, I think, probably do a Random Rush today on the better half. All that and more. And, folks, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You get a coupon code discount, 10% off. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. If you buy your crap through Amazon, as you begin to get your Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Christmas and maybe Thanksgiving gifts, maybe, or maybe people's birthdays fall in this time of year, buy it through our Amazon link. You can find it at majority.fm. I know many of you always try to remember to use that link, but you forget. What you need to do is go to the homepage, click it, bookmark it, and then keep the bookmark up there. And every time you go through Amazon, just click that bookmark, buy the stuff there. We will get a little kickback. You won't notice a difference, but it will make our day a little bit happier. We just bought Matt a pair of headphones because he's wearing headphones like 8 hours a day, and his ears are beginning to fall off because the foam on the old ones has been corrupted. And when Matt's in a bad mood, everybody's in a bad mood around here. When Michael's in a bad mood, everybody's actually sort of laughing about it.
Oh, well,
people enjoy it when you're in a bad mood.
I'm not usually in a bad mood.
Well,
I'm kind of actually the harbinger of emotional sanity and health in this office.
Well, whatever you say.
Yeah.
All right, folks. We're gonna
take a break. Let's not add to Michael's burden.
No.
Yeah, we don't want Michael complaining now. Like, I'm the one who's supposed to be happy all the time. That's a lot of work. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. You can also Michael's going on early vacation. You can also IM us at Majority FM.
Oh, another one of those like yoga trips are coming up soon.
Trips coming up soon. Double up, buddy.
All right, folks. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this.